This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On a Tuesday, we continue. And joining me is Alex Hollings. He's a he's become a crowd favorite here on All Marine Radio. Alex,
oh man, I'm happy to hear it.
Well, you got your fans here, man. You started out as a nobody, and why did I have you on the program the first time?
I have to assume it was just something like, we're bringing in these guys that don't leave their basements because they're writing all the time, and it must have been community service or maybe something like that.
I don't. Did somebody introduce us? How did we even meet?
I really don't remember, to be honest with you. I know that right from the start I came on to talk about some foreign policy news stories, but I don't remember if there was maybe some one big story that was a catalyst you needed somebody. The weirdest thing. I genuinely don't remember how we started doing this.
Did you write some kind of crazy shit that I read and said, who is this dude?
Lord knows, I do tend to write some crazy shit.
I know. Somebody told me about you. I think that's how we met. Somebody said, hey, man, there's a Marine that's riding, you should check his shit out. I think that's how I initially saw you. But
you know, over the years, I mean, we have been doing this, I want to say, for a couple of years now, right?
I'd have to look it up, but it's been a while.
You know, and I'll say my career has changed along the way. You know what I mean? But the one thing that stayed constant is coming back here and getting to have great conversations about what the hell is going on in the world. It's nice to have this, like, base of operations to come back to. It's like coming back to base camp every other week, you know?
Well, I think part of you is made to do this because, one, you talk really fast, and two, you never, ever at a loss for words, which means you were born to do radio and podcasting.
Just imagine what it must be like to be married to me, my poor wife. I am never at a loss for words. I went to school for radio for a really short time. One of the five times I dropped out of college was pursuing radio.
Only dorks, man. That's like a room full of dorks right there.
You know, but it was my kind of dorks. I really did enjoy it. But at the time, you know, I was going to school on a scholarship. It was. Initially, when I graduated high school, I wanted to go play college football, but I broke my leg my senior year really bad, and so I wasn't able to go pursue college ball, so I just threw a fit and went to Alaska instead, you know, and which was a crazy, crazy thing to do at the time, but I think it actually was the right move for me, you know, and so I came back after a semester and started going to school on a scholarship and had no idea how fortunate I was to have a scholarship paying my way through school. So I went to school for a year for radio, and I think in my head just thought, oh, well, I got this scholarship. I can always get another one. And I dropped out to go become a mechanic for a race team. And then it took me years to get back. I had to join the Marine Corps to find a way to pay for it.
There you go.
So stay in school, kids.
The moral of the story is they're not easy to come by. Now, before we talk about you, Alex and I were kind of chatting before we came on. You hear about post-traumatic winning.
I do. I'm telling you, this is the coolest thing about my job is that I work, you know, in the media. So most of the veterans and the Marines that I interact with on a daily basis are media personalities, you know, which kind of exist inside this alternate reality bubble where we all lead double lives, right? We're all both our public personality and our in private, you know, drunk asshole selves. And we need to keep those separated, you know? So, like, when you interact with media personalities, you know, you always – your first pass is always with their, you know, caricature. But when I hear about All Marine winning from Marines, from guys I know in real life, out in its natural habitat, post-traumatic winning's natural habitat, that's the coolest thing in the world to me. You know, my buddy Josh, he's a Marine Corps officer, was actually at one of your presentations.
Oh,
and when I mentioned that I was going on All Marine Radio, and he was like, wait, the post-traumatic winning guy, right? And I said, yeah, you know, he's a good friend of mine. And he was, dude, the presentation was awesome. You know, the content was awesome. It's great to hear that from real guys in the real world. I love it, man.
No, no. You said that. It's like I tell people, kind of joking, but not really, that I'm the coolest person I know because I have those, like, just like Alex saying that to me. So here's Alex talking to somebody that has been to, you know, post-traumatic winning and tells him, no, man, it was awesome, that drops in your lap out of the blue.
You know, and we're talking about a guy, a prior enlisted guy who commissioned, who's seen the Marine Corps from just about every corner you can see it from. You know, he was a gunny before he was an officer. And so for him to say this is really important, you know, that's a duty expert. That's a subject matter expert. That's the guy you're trying to engage directly, saying that this is awesome and I'm glad I went to it. You know, that's awesome, man.
And you know what I love about the presentation, one of the things I love a lot about the presentation because I put it together, but really what I did was I just kind of got my hands around the things I've heard on this program for almost 3 years, and a lot of that comes from out of the enlisted Marine Corps. It is the plain spoken truths of a culture that tried to take care of each other long before there was a PTSD diagnosis, and they said these things to each other. And so to me, that's why I've never had got an email saying, I think your sixth commandment's bullshit. Cause it's all plain spoken from our culture.
And you know that if people thought it was, you would get that email. Marines aren't going to mince their words with you about this.
Are you kidding me? And you know, just the snarky assholes that are out there that, you know, I thought it was kind of good, except I'll give you some feedback. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Give me some feedback. Give me some feedback, bro. Because, you know, they got to find something wrong with it. I'm a PhD and, like, okay, I'm all ears, man. Let me hear it.
I don't like the way you said this.
I think you should say this. Like,
I run into that a lot with my work because people feel as though I think that there's a certain element of I'm going to offer you some criticism because it shows how closely I was paying attention. And I think that people, to a certain extent, think that that's flattery. You know, like, they want to show that your peers, that they're not like a fanboy, you know.
Right.
First of all, I'm not cool enough to have fanboys. So if you reach out to me on social media or email, I may not always get to it because I do get a lot of hate mail sometimes. But I certainly don't think that you're some fanboy. So you don't need to demonstrate to me your expertise by shitting over something that I've worked on.
That is kind of like another dog pissing on your piss, right?
Yeah. All the time I'll get stuff from, especially from academics. You know, a lot of the feedback I get from academics are, you know, I really liked this piece of analysis work that you did, but in my PhD thesis, I included this. And I'm like, dude, I'm not gonna read your PhD thesis right now. Like, I've got a deadline. I appreciate it. But that said, you know, a lot of times these guys are experts, and a lot of times they do have good feedback. But it's that natural instinct to lead to – did you ever hear of the mystery method? It was like an MTV show for a while back in the day about how to pick up girls.
No.
And I wrote an article about it for a different website a long time ago because it was just heinous. This idea that, like, you should wear a ridiculous hat and be rude to women, and that's how you get women. But it was all based on this mystery method, which was derived from this guy named Mystery, saying that this is how he got women. It was all horrible. But one of the things that came of it was the idea of negging, right? And so what they would recommend is
when you approach a woman. Yeah, I mean, what is that? What is negging?
So negging is negative reinforcement. So you approach a woman in like a crowded bar,
right,
and you give them an underhanded compliment or a backhanded compliment that's supposed to make them feel bad about themselves and demonstrate just how socially superior you are, that you'd be willing to be a dick to this woman you're interested in. And according to the mystery method, this is the way that you can get a woman to be interested in you. According to real life, this is the way that you get a woman to think you're an asshole. You know, and I see the exact same approach all the time from aspiring writers, from pundits, you know, people who are, you know, I get things all the time like, hey, I'm really interested in writing. I was wondering if maybe you could help me, you know, get my foot in the door with one of these publications. And I wanted to tell you, I read your piece about this and I thought this was stupid. It's like, all right, man. I'd be happy to help you. You don't need to tell me that you think I suck.
But it does. So how do you take personal criticism? Do you take it well or does it bother you?
It all depends on the approach. I'll say this. The criticism that I take to heart, which is probably the reason why parts of me are not well suited for this line of work, is when I get well thought out, articulate criticism – that rings true, It hurts. Like, I can feel it like a bell ringing in my chest for days. You know, when sometimes I'll write an analysis piece or an op-ed, and I feel really strongly about it while I'm writing it, you know what I mean? And I'll feel as though it's a well-reasoned argument. And then, you know, you'll get some feedback where someone's like, you know, I disagree with you on these points, and that's totally fine. More often than not, I'll be like, I see where you're coming from, but I stand by my position. But every once in a while, you get that one. That's, they're not just attacking you. It's not all in caps lock. It's reasonable. It's well-informed. It's like, hey, I really think you're wrong, and these are why. And worse, this is why you're such a bad person for having the position that you have. Every once in a while, those just get me, you know? But for the most part, the hate mail I get is all in capital letters. A lot of it's misspelled, and it's usually accusing me of being a Russian spy or a Chinese spy or... I have a bunch of voicemails from some Russian guy who says he's going to release information proving that I'm a war criminal alongside James Mattis, which would be great for my career if he could drum up some evidence that said Mattis and I were running around Ramadi committing war crimes together. Like, so some of it is really easy to ignore because it's just crazy.
Right.
But some of it, when it's right, when it's accurate and true, it can really hurt. You know, and I try my best to respond to those sincerely, even when they're kind of not in, even if your intentions were maybe negative, I try to respond to those in a positive way and say, I really appreciate, you know, you pointing me in the right direction on this. You know, maybe I need to reassess my position. And if you can get me to respond to you and say, shit, man, maybe I was wrong, that's a solid way for you to know that I've been carrying this one around like a weight on my shoulders for 3 days. You know?
No, I'll tell you, I'm not okay. You know, it bothers me. And I don't mean just the, you know, just the stupid stuff. But as you said, when somebody, you know, it always makes me think, you know, and I know some people that say, oh, you know, they're always out there. I don't pay any attention to them.
Oh, yeah, and I know plenty of guys who say, just don't read the comments at all. And to an extent, they may be right.
Right.
But to me, it's my opportunity to see how people are because a big part of what I've been doing for the last couple of years is trying to take complicated topics and boil them down into something that you can, to be totally frank, something that you can understand in the span of one shit at work, right?
Which is the challenge of the modern media, yes?
Absolutely, absolutely, you know, and so... Because my goal is to try to boil something, and it's not that I don't think readers can understand a complex topic, it's that I don't think readers have the time or the bandwidth to stay on top of the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, out of China, as well as the staff meetings that they have for their job and picking up, you know, their daughter at Little League practice and trying to fit the time in, you know, to hang out with their husband or wife, trying to watch the new Game of Thrones and trying to get a good night's sleep. You don't have time to spend 10 hours a day like I do plugged in. Right. So the comments are a really good litmus test for me to see if the way that I took this complex thing and tried to relay it. A lot of times the comments are for people who didn't read the article at all, obviously, you know, but when you come across those comments where they're like, well, this part right here kind of misrepresented this. My goal is never to misrepresent something. Right. So anytime somebody accuses me of that, that's something I try to be aware of. I try to be cognizant of it so that I can keep an eye out for it, you know, to make sure that I don't do that. If I did do it, you know, maybe I need to address that. And if I don't feel as though I did do it, maybe I just need to be more aware of how I'm choosing my words, you know?
Wow, who knew that you were such a big guy, so sensitive?
Yeah, I honestly, this makes me sound cooler than I am. I probably get 100-plus messages a week across Twitter, Facebook, email, whatever it may be, Instagram. I probably only really, really read a third of them.
Oh,
you know,
kind of extrapolate. That hurt.
You know, because
all those messages people, I'm telling you what a jackass you are, you don't even read them?
Well, I always read yours.
No, the ones I really tee up, I use a different email account.
As I'm scrolling through, if your message is in all capital letters, I almost always skip it. If there's profanity in the subject line, I almost always skip it.
What?
If you're accusing me of working for a foreign nation in the first line, I almost always skip it. If anything, if you read my work consistently, you know that I have a pretty big pro-America bias. So I especially love when people accuse me of being a Russian propaganda mouthpiece, where I'm like, the breadth of my work has been about what a garbage fire the Russian government and military is. So you obviously haven't done more than read one headline and make your decisions about me. You know what I mean?
I want to ask you a professional question in terms of writing. So you say you try to make it understandable, but it's got to be relatively brief, right? How statistically can you tell me how long does the average person look at an article?
I can tell you that the general rules of thumb throughout the industry tend to be around 800 words is about as long as you're going to get your average person to pay attention during the workday. 300 to 500 is generally considered to be the sweet spot for content like that. When it comes to analysis pieces, however, like if I'm writing something that's like a real analysis piece, my word count is regularly over 2,000 words because I don't expect you to like really quickly hop into a deep dive into, you know, like the data systems employed by the F-35, you know, if you're just looking for a couple of minutes to kill while you're pumping gas. So those pieces, like I'm writing an article right now for Popular Mechanics about the F-14 Tomcat. My first draft on that story was 2,600 words, you know, whereas a story that I know you're probably just going to click on in passing, maybe from the toilet at work because you want to know what happened today with in the Norwegian Maritime Institute just accused Russia of having military beluga whales deployed in the Arctic Circle.
I saw that. Who else would put a belt and some kind of harness on a beluga whale?
Well, I mean, that says property of St. Petersburg right on it. I don't know. That's not a very clandestine operation.
Hey, nobody's accused the Russians of being the sharpest knives in the drawer.
People don't realize all the time. People tend to think that Russia's secretive and covert operations are some of the best in the world. That's not the case at all. Russia has perhaps the most audacious covert operations in the modern world, and because of that, we tend to think they must have other really, really elaborate schemes going on, because we catch them red-handed all the time in these ham-fisted, you know, efforts to steal evidence, you know, from international investigations and things. And we're like, man, they must have this really elaborate system. No, or we just caught them. You know, they might just suck.
I read an article in the last couple weeks about somebody that had been recruited at a gun show who wanted to and become a mercenary in that Wagner organization that is a paramilitary organization that Little Green Men come from and things like that. And the story is like blunt, stupid, and yeah, they saw me at a gun show. They got my phone number. They called me, said they wanted me to go to the Ukraine. Then they gave me a picture of this guy and two guns, and they told me to kill him. So I got drunk and I killed him, and I got caught, and now I'm in jail. And you know, it's former KGB people, and so you're like, that's it.
I will tell you this: that's one of the other very frequent forms of emails or social media contacts that I get is because of my time working for SOFREP prior to it being NewsRep. And for those who aren't familiar with SOFREP, SOFREP stands for Special Operation Force Report. You know, the same way a SITREP for most of us on the conventional side, a SOFREP is just a SITREP for guys with something cooler on their collar or their shoulder, you know, a Ranger tab or a Trident or what have you. And so SOFREP was the name of NewsRep before the transition. And other than me, everybody who worked at SOFREP were special operations veterans. You know, I was the token pogue in a group of some of the best, most elite warfighters of our generation. You know, to this day, one of my proudest, you know, professional accomplishments is working with guys like Jack Murphy, who was a Green Beret and a Ranger, you know, George Hand, who was in Delta for 15 plus years, you know. And so I regularly still get people emailing me, especially for foreign countries, asking how to get into mercenary work. I constantly get ones asking me to, like, pull strings because, you know, I'm a very good driver and I have my CDL in Brazil. you know, and things like that. And I'm like, guys, you must not have Googled me. I don't know how you found my email address. But there's 16 guys that I work with that would probably be better suited for this line of questioning. So if you couldn't do enough research to figure out which one of us to email, I'm not so sure that you've got a real future in this industry.
Wow.
You know, but I mean, Kurt Trotter being a great example was one of the guys I worked with. He was a supply guy in the Marine Corps. He was a box kicker. And I don't want to go too deep into his personal story, but he got into an altercation, a self-defense shooting stateside, after he got out of the Marine Corps. He did his 4 years, got out. He was with his aunt at a mall, and they got confronted by someone who drew a weapon. Kurt had his – he had, I believe, a Glock with him, concealed carry. He drew his weapon. He killed the guy. And I think for a lot of people, that's – taking someone else's life, I'm not speaking from experience, but taking someone else's life tends to be a watershed moment. You either realize that the incredible weight of taking someone else's life is more than you might have thought in the past, or in Kurt's case, you realize that as serious as it is, as horrible as it is, he's built of the type of stuff that can manage just fine under those circumstances. And it was because of that was the catalyst that led him to volunteering with the Peshmerga and fighting ISIS. You know, as an American that traveled back to Iraq, and since then he's traveled to a number of other countries doing contract work and stuff. But, you know, Kurt's a great example. If he was a pogue in the Marine Corps, he was a box kicker, and it took some extenuating circumstances for him to realize what it was that he was made of, you know. And then, you know, that took him on a completely different track in life. Guys like that are the guy you want to email if you want to get into mercenary work, you know, if you want to get into contract work. Me, you know, writing technical analysis pieces about retired airplanes, I'm not really the guy, you know?
But they think you are, which is probably the most important part of it. That picture of you with the big red beard and the watch cap on, that's pretty macho.
Well, I'll say that's the part I'm the most excited about. This new job I'm starting this week is the chance to get back out into the field. You know, I've been... Well, I might as well. I'll just say it. I haven't said this anywhere yet, so I'll say it now. I'm leaving news.
Hold on. Let me play some music. All right.
Oh, bit of dramatic.
Yeah. Let me play. Let me play some important. Hold on. We have a big announcement coming up.
Big announcement, yeah. You know, this is actually, I think, the second time.
You're supposed to let the music clear, butthead, okay?
I decided to stop and just bask in the glow of my dramatic intro. But your show was also where I announced that my book was for sale. This is the second time that I'm making career announcements on All Marine Radio.
We love it. We love it. We feel like we're family now. What the hell? Why not?
We are family. You know, somebody asked me about you not long ago, and I told them that you called me while my wife was in labor, which is not something that – I mean, I work with a lot of people doing podcast stuff or writing stuff. Nobody called me while my wife was in labor but you. You know, you're a genuinely good guy.
I offered because I'm one of the great labor coaches in the history of the planet.
Honestly. I don't remember what you said to me, but honestly, I do remember it helping.
I can help.
You know, I was all worried because my wife's epidural had worn off, and she was furious and upset. She was in labor for 23 hours.
Oh, shit.
You know, and you just happened to call when I was, like, reaching the end of my rope. You know, and it was the right time. I needed that pep talk.
I've done it four times, and I've seen it go easy. I've seen it not go so easy. So I'm like a quality. I tell women, hey, if your husband, if he's not up to it, call me, man. I'll be your coach.
If he's not up to it.
Yeah, if he's not up to the task, I'm like, I come with credentials.
But now I've blown the musical intro to my
novel. I know.
So I'll just make it. So I'm no longer going to be writing for NewsRep anymore as of Tuesday. I'm still working for the same parent company, Hurricane, which owns NewsRep, but I'm moving on to what I think will be a better fit for me. I'm taking over as the managing editor of a website called The Loadout Room. It's at loadoutroom.com. We do military gear reviews, but It's not all military gear. For a long time it was, but we, you know, as of late, Scott Whitner, who was the previous managing editor, who I can't say enough good things about, he was working on a transition towards more of a general lifestyle, survival, being an overall well-prepared person. And that's the direction that we're going to be moving in with the loadout room. I'm going to be doing a lot more stuff outside.
That's you, though, man. I just saw that you on Facebook, because we're friends, you just, like, squared away your knife-making room. And
I've been making knives for a few years now, I love making knives because it's cathartic and therapeutic, you know. But I will say that it makes me uniquely suited to be a real dick when it comes to reviewing other people's knives.
But my point being is that you are, right, you're kind of made in this genre of being a gear asshole, and so reviewing other people's shit is something that a guy with a shop like yours that has all those cool flags hanging in it, you're kind of made for this. Will we see a signature series of knives at some point on the website? I'm looking at it right now, and it's got a lot of gear on it. Will we see a signature?
I'm gonna level with you, probably not, only because, so I've got this personal thing when it comes to my knives, where I don't want to sell them. I don't want to take money for them, because it takes away all the magic of why I'm doing it.
Are they art?
I guess in a way, like, when I make a knife for somebody, like, you know, and I've made a couple of knives for close friends and things like that. It wouldn't be such an important gesture anymore if they gave me $50, you know, or if I tried to associate a cost to a knife. In my head, immediately, I'm going to start doing math about how long it takes me to make it,
right,
and the materials that I put in it, and what value does this knife actually have. And I'll level with you, more often than not, what the knife would be worth to me isn't really what the going rate would be for a knife, because I spent a month pouring my heart into this blade. You could probably get one just as good, you know, for the same price from some large manufacturer, you know. But to me, it means much more than that, because I spent a month working on this knife, and I don't want to attach prices to it, because if I start doing math in my head, I'm going to start cutting corners or feeling pressure or being stressed, and I would really much rather just unplug my brain, go into the workshop, and just make the best knife that I can make, you know what I mean, and go from there, I guess.
Wow.
Maybe one day, but
you're an artist. You're an artist.
I wouldn't call it art because I'm a ham-fisted idiot.
But here's what you have to understand. Even a ham-fisted idiot can be an artist. Don't you know?
Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm just uncomfortable calling it art because that seems pretentious.
I think that the label might be a little bit intimidating. But I think that's what you are. You're a knife artist.
You know, because I've had people talk about art with writing before, too. And I do think that there's a way to pursue writing that is genuinely an art form. But I also think that there tends to be a blue-collar way to pursue writing. For the most part, my day-to-day life is blue-collar writing. I'm taking information and relaying it the best ways that I can for people to absorb the best ways that they can. But every once in a while, I get to do writing that I would consider to be more on the art side. I would some writers, I mentioned him earlier, George Hand is the type of dude who every time he writes, it's like Ernest Hemingway. He's putting together sentences. The flow of a sentence is important to him just as much as the overall narrative, you know. There is a real way to pursue art and write, I guess, in just about anything that you do. But there's also a way to blue-collar it. And I guess that's what I'm afraid of doing with my knives, is if I start trying to sell them and putting a price on it, I'm going to blue collar it. I'm going to turn it into doing work instead of just doing what I do, you know? So maybe you're right. Maybe it's art, but you'll be hard pressed to get me to call it that.
Well, you're a modest person.
Only sometimes. I'm happy to tell you how good I am at, you know, Mario Kart.
please don't. You know? Please spare us from that. So more career news for you, and so that'll be. So does the job, for instance, you were the managing editor at Fightersweep.com.
I was up until recently. Fightersweep is also owned by the same parent company. So Hurricane Group owns a number of properties, and Fighter Sweep, when I took it over, was a website that had been laying dormant for some time. And really, I realize now what it was an audition. At the time, I thought that it was Fighter Sweep is what I'm going to be doing from now on, you know? So I really dove into Fightersweep.com with the idea that I wanted to do some really good, hard-hitting, aviation-related analysis work. But a part of that, a part of the role of editor at a website, anytime you're managing a website, you're a slave to two masters. The first one is trying to make sure you produce good content. The second one is trying to find a way to get people to care about that good content, right? And those aren't always the same. Just making good content, you would think, is enough to find an audience. But in today's world, there's lots of good content out there, you know? And it's more important that you find a way to engage people so that they'll find that content. And at Fighter Sweep, I really devoted a lot of time to trying to grow the brand that was Fighter Sweep. And I'm proud to say that over the months that I was running it, it was getting the best traffic in the history of the website, you know, in its 5-year run. Fighter Sweep is not dead, but it is dormant once again now. It's a smaller site, you know, and as the company was restructuring and they're moving things around and looking for the right ways to move into the future, the Loadout Room is one of the company's biggest brands, you know, and so
what we've done is we've taken our rising star and we've coupled them with our strongest brand, and we expect great things. Well, don't screw that up.
Yeah, I hope so. I'll say the stakes are significantly higher for me this time around. Over at Fighter Sweep, it was a website that had been asleep.
Shit.
You know, it was in hibernation, so it's really easy to look like you're doing a good job when you're competing against hibernation.
Exactly.
You know,
hibernation is a relatively low bar.
Yeah, you know,
if you can't outperform hibernation.
Yeah, then you're in trouble, right? You know, so it took a couple of months for me to get Fighter Sweep to a place where it was doing better than it had, you know, under previous editors. And I took a lot of pride in that. You know, I really did. To be totally honest with you, I was even, without knowing what the future held, you know, as these moves were being moved into place, you know, changed around, I was really bummed to leave Fighter Sweep behind after spending 6 months, you know, devoting myself to it. But I see now that the opportunity I've got at the Loadout Room is great. You know, we have 25 contributors at the Loadout Room. Make that 26. I just brought on another one yesterday. And, you know, we've got everything from Green Berets to just fly fisherman instructors. I don't mean to say just. From Green Berets to fly fisherman instructors whose job is to test out this gear that you can find online and give you an informed and reasonable review on it as to whether or not this is really worth you spending your hard-earned paycheck on. It's near and dear to my heart because I've always liked taking a budget-friendly approach to, like, my own home defense, my own self-defense stuff. So I'm going to be taking a slightly different angle than maybe some previous Loadout Room guys have because my focus is always on finding ways to be effective without breaking the bank. I'm not that excited about a new piece of gear that costs $6,000 because very few of us can afford that, you know. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be different. You know, I won't be talking about North Korea and, you know, the South China Sea every day. Instead, I'm going to be getting my hands on some of the best new gear that our military guys have got their hands on that will be available on the commercial side, and I'll get to go out and take it through its paces and let you guys know what I think.
So, but you can always come back on here and talk about international news if you want to.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'll still be writing for Popular Mechanics, so I'll still be doing a lot of defense technology analysis work. You know, I also write for We Are the Mighty, so you'll be able to find a lot of my stuff over there. So
write, We Are the Mighty, that's all things, you know, kind of military veteran related. Did they hire you to write along a specific line?
Oh, they did, yeah. So I just accepted a gig as a contributor with them recently, working primarily in fitness and tactical stuff. But, the way any of these things work, We Are the Mighty included, is you pitch stories to them, right? So, you know, you get a hold of their editors, or you sit in a meeting, or depending on which outlet it is, some of them have, like, living spreadsheets. Some of them just have an email policy. Some of them have what's called a content management system that you submit pitches through. And then you get a little bit of a give or take on some pitches. Sometimes they'll say, I like this, but maybe focus a bit more on that. Other times they'll just say, yeah, man, that's it. Run with it. Other times they'll just say, no, we're not interested in this. So with We Are the Mighty, they have a pitch system where you go in and you pitch the ideas that you have for stories, and their editor staff help you mold those pitches into things that they think fit well for their brand, and things that they think will fit well for their audience. And so I just had a story published with We Are the Mighty not long ago talking about my experiences playing football for the Marine Corps, you know, which is something I don't think a lot of people know about. You know, the Marine Corps football leagues aren't something you see in recruiting posters or things like that. But for me, it was maybe one of the most fulfilling things I got to do as a Marine was play football for 2 years, first on my battalion team, then on my base team, and then on our regional team. It was a great experience, and, you know, so it was awesome to get to shine a light on that. And We Are the Mighty focuses on that sort of content, you know, stuff for military and for veterans, you know, that kind of speaks to the way we lead our lives, you know?
The all right, so what are we talking about today other than your career?
Oh, man, well, there's always plenty of stuff on fire around the world. We can talk about a Russian spy whale that Norway...
Yeah, I saw the picture of that. I chuckled when I saw it because there's no doubt that it's true. Explain to everybody what you're talking about.
So it's just so ludicrous that it seems entirely feasible to me. Right. The Norwegian, I think it's the Norwegian Maritime Institute or Marine Institute of something. At any rate, a beluga whale was reported harassing Norwegian fishing boats in the Arctic Circle in recent weeks. So. Whatever the Marine Institute was, they deployed a vessel to go and try to net this whale and figure out what was going on with it. But as they approached it, their intent was to capture it with nets. They realized that this whale was tame. It came right up to the boat. You can actually watch a YouTube video of it. It came right up to the boat and basically asked for something to eat. And so, you know, they fed it some fish and it became their best friend. Very clearly
now,
is
there any truth to the rumor that the way they tracked the whale was by empty vodka bottles that were floating on top of the water?
It could be. That might have been what was on the harness. The whale was wearing a harness that had an attachment so that you could put something like a GoPro camera or a small camera like that on the harness. And the harness itself said in English, property of St. Petersburg, which you would argue is almost like planted evidence, right? That's so conspicuous that how could it not be? I would contend that that's no different than Russia using, like, legitimate GRU officials to try to conduct covert operations in the UK in the past year. So as soon as they were arrested, it was easy to immediately tie them back to the Kremlin. The Kremlin's not very good at covering their tracks because they know they can just say six different things in the news today and we'll all forget about it tomorrow anyway. You know, so I definitely do think that the whale was of Russian descent, I guess, if you will. You could debate that maybe it was someone's private whale that got loose. I think that's unlikely. I think it's more likely that that whale was meant to keep an eye out for either undersea or surface naval activity in the Arctic. And I think that we'd be remiss to think that there aren't more aquatic wildlife out there wearing Russian harnesses. Now, Russia does not have a formally acknowledged whale or dolphin naval program, but they certainly have in the past, as has the United States. You know, the Soviet Union very famously had a dolphin program where those dolphins were trained to identify mines. They were also trained to, at least in theory, set explosives underwater. We do know that in 2016, the Russian Ministry of Defense published a request to purchase 5 dolphins for experimentation, but there's been no subsequent press releases or any information out of the Kremlin pertaining to whether or not they did secure those dolphins or what the program may have been. So we certainly know, A, that Russia has a background in training marine mammals for naval activities. We also know that they have a contemporary interest, at least dating back to 2016, but there is no real formal evidence other than the harness that beluga whale was wearing to tie it to the Kremlin. But because of Russia's massive expansion throughout the Arctic in the last 2 years, and I really do mean massive, there's new air installations. They've got squadrons of MiG-31s deployed there now. Russia really is trying to lay claim to as much of the Arctic as they can. I don't think that it would be outside the realm of possibility at all to assume that they're using some, you know, wildlife that's native to that region to keep tabs on what's going on underneath the ice, you know?
how drunk, given the level of activity that currently exists in the Arctic, how drunk do you think those Russian pilots are?
You know, you got to wonder. Because, like, those MiGs, for instance, we're talking about, I want to say it was a MiG-31, maybe a MiG-2, whatever it was, we're talking about the fastest Russian fighter jet ever made. These things can go Mach, in excess of Mach 3. They were purpose-built to chase down the SR-71, right? Here's the thing, though. They haven't been maintained very well ever since. And they're no longer rated to go at their top speed because the glass that the cockpit canopies are made of are original to when the aircraft were first deployed in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
So now they're fairly certain that if you exceed Mach like 1.2, the cockpits will just shatter. So these incredibly powerful, they're drag racing fighter jets, you know what I mean?
And
like they're dragsters.
How would they know such a thing?
I have to assume
somebody,
they
right?
heard they learned it the hard way. Yeah, I have to assume.
Some poor pilot up there saying, being told, hey, we want you to at least go Mach 2 today, got it, ate a cockpit.
Yeah, exactly. And then, and Lord knows whether or not he survived, or whether or not they just airbrushed him out of the squadron photos like they did with their old space program. You know? I mean, you do hear interesting stuff all the time. A MiG-31, which is the type of aircraft we're talking about, I want to say it was last year, a Russian pilot shot his wingman down in training. And the story only reached the international media in the last couple of weeks. Russia's really good at keeping these things quiet, you know, which speaks to their latest effort to censor their internet and establish kind of like the Great Wall that China maintains, the Great Firewall. Russia wants to establish their own so that they can separate the Russian internet from outside access, and it will also allow them to censor the content that's published within their own intranet of sorts. And that's just another means of control to make sure that the next time they shoot one of their own fighter jets down, that story doesn't make its way out of the former Soviet bloc, if you will.
Nice,
you know?
Nice. My guest, obviously, is Alex Hollings. How do I introduce you?
Well, so as of Wednesday, I am the managing editor of the Loadout Room. That's my new home and claim to fame.
There you have it. So all things there and two pertaining. The Loadout Room. You can give everybody the website address one more time.
Loadoutroom.com. You can also find my work on Popular Mechanics. You can find it on We Are the Mighty Now. Wow. And of course, you can always find literally thousands of my previous articles on NewsRep, thenewsrep.com. And, you know, and I obviously I'm still maintaining good ties with those guys. Jack Murphy is the editor-in-chief over there. And as far as this industry goes, I don't think anybody has helped me more in terms of learning, you know, just the trade, and in terms of just general advice than Jack Murphy. So really, you know, I would love to encourage people to continue going to NewsRep for great content. You're still going to get great content, just unfortunately it won't be from me anymore, but it's still a great website. And, of course, you can find me on social media on Facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter. You can find me on Twitter at AlexHollings52. You can find me on Instagram at Archetype52, which is usually not really one of my professional outlets, but I'm going to be doing so much cool field work and taking pictures out, you know, in the woods and stuff that, you know, feel free to hunt me down on there. And if all of that isn't enough, you can also find me on alexhollings.com, where you'll find links to All Marine Radio and Popular Mechanics and all the rest of the crazy stuff I'm doing.
Wow. Listen to that. If that's not a mouthful, what the hell?
I'm busy, man.
Yeah. Why don't you add a little current events onto the Loadout Room?
Well, you know, there may well be. We'll see. The first thing that I need to do, to be totally frank,
yes.
Scott Whitner, who's been running the Loadout Room up until this week, he's running it still until Wednesday, has done such an excellent job managing this website and managing the team over there that the first thing that I need to be able to do is come in and take over day-to-day operations without breaking it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So my first focus is, before I work on making changes to the content style or shifting anything towards, you know, what my vision for the future is or what corporate's vision for the future is, the first thing I need to do is do this website justice. And I may have been in this industry for a while. I may have run a couple of websites, but every website is unique and every audience is unique. I want to try to bring the guys that are familiar with me to the Loadout Room, but I don't want to alienate the guys that already love the Loadout Room,
right,
you know?
Right.
So there's going to be some changes for sure here, you know, in the coming year. But they're going to trickle out, you know, because the first thing I got to do is learn how to ride this bike, and then I can start tricking it out.
Yeah, you know, the first, you know, to quote a Matticism, first do no harm.
Yeah, you know, so in the loadout room, it average, you know, we get 250,000 views a week, you know, there's, it's already got, a good strong audience, which makes this such an incredible opportunity and a daunting challenge for me. You know, it's hard to improve upon something that's already doing really well, but hopefully I can. You know, I feel as though I've got the right plan in place, you know, so we'll see.
All right. Let's talk about current events. What going on the planet right now has your attention?
Well, it's always worth worrying about what's going on in the South China Sea. And I don't mean because we're going to go to war with China next week. We won't. I do think that unless something significant shifts in the next 50 to 100 years, we are on the path to war with China, which would truly, in a lot of respects, be World War III. I say 50 to 100 years, which means that there's ample opportunity for it not to happen, you know, but we're on that course. And so right now we're again seeing tensions escalating between China and Taiwan, bolstered by the United States doing these freedom of navigation voyages. What a freedom of navigation voyage effectively is it's where when another nation establishes what we deem to be unlawful requirements or limitations on where you could take your ships, we conduct freedom of navigation voyages right through where you say we can't take them to show you that the United States Navy is not afraid of your stipulations. You know, we did this, I want to say, in Yemen in the 80s, which actually led to a couple of dogfights between carrier-based aircraft and their air force. And now we're doing it in the Pacific with China, particularly in regards to the South China Sea, but also in other places where China is asserting its influence in ways that the local governments, Taiwan, China considers to be a part of, you know, the Taiwan Strait, China considers itself to own. You know, Hong Kong is another good example of these regions that govern themselves but have these really complex relationships with the Chinese government that we need to find ways to dance around diplomatically. And so these freedom of navigation voyages we're having through the Taiwan Strait and stuff, they escalate tensions with China, but it's our way of demonstrating that we do defend the sovereignty of these regions, of these nations that China considers to be a part of their own. It's not necessarily – I would liken these types of operations to the same thing as when you hear about Russian bombers or fighters being intercepted off the coast of Alaska or over the Mediterranean. It happens so often that we tend to go numb to it. But we need to remember from a foreign policy and a diplomacy standpoint that this is a part of a constant posturing, you know? And so if we get lackadaisical with it, if we stop paying attention to it, that's ultimately what their goal is. Russia wants us to be so comfortable and familiar with their long-range nuclear-capable bombers hanging out right above Alaskan shores, hanging out over the Mediterranean, that we barely think twice about it when and if war ever does break out. China likewise wants us to become so accustomed to hearing about these freedom of navigation voyages, hearing about this tension in the South China Sea, that we dismiss it the same way we tend to with the war in Afghanistan. You know, the All Marine Radio listener base tends to be probably some of the best informed when it comes to the conflicts that America is involved with, because most of the listeners tend to be Marines or no Marines, you know, attached to the veteran community. Your average news reader, your average news watcher doesn't care much about Afghanistan, nor do they care much about bomber intercepts in Alaska or the South China Sea. And that inundation of information represents a real threat to our foreign interests in the future, because a war that the American people can't get behind is a war that we will lose, you know? So it's always worth paying attention, even if you're sick of it. It's always worth clicking on an article about what's going on in the South China Sea. You'll see some new ones from me this week. I may not be writing about the South China Sea quite as much here in the near future, but I encourage people, I'll still be staying up on it. I'll still be ranting and raving about it every opportunity that I get. And I think it would behoove the American people to pay attention.
I saw an article about the South China Sea that talks about well, I called it Little Green Men, but it's the Chinese militia, the naval
militia. The maritime militia, yeah.
Which is increasing. And really, what the maritime militia is, it is regular, I would probably say Chinese Special Forces and sailors on fishing boats roaming around doing things for the Chinese Navy.
Don't realize this, but if you combine the Chinese Navy with their maritime militia and their Coast Guard, China has, in the neighborhood around China, more than 650 large vessels. Now, the American Navy is talking about trying desperately to find a way to get to a 355-ship fleet.
Total, around the world.
Around the world. And it's important that people understand that that full 355-ship Navy could not possibly be deployed in the Pacific against a single opponent without destabilizing large regions of the world elsewhere. Then America's naval presence belongs there to keep global keep the global economy working effectively. You know, you think about piracy in the Horn of Africa. A big reason why you'll see that is because there isn't a sufficient and significant naval presence in that region to combat that. And every time you start to see the naval presence start to wane, you start to see piracy crop up again. The American Navy, people don't realize, why does America spend so much money on defense? It's because we really do police the planet in a lot of ways. The global economy is dependent and reliant in many ways on the American military might that's right around the corner that keeps these regions stable, you know? So if we were to pull all of our resources, every Navy ship in the American...
Hold on. So the reason we keep it stable is why?
Well, because it not only maintains our economy, it maintains the global economy, which in turn maintains our economy. We really do turn a significant profit by being the global diplomatic and military power, global commerce.
We don't do it for altruistic reasons.
Absolutely not. And this is actually – that speaks to the Belt and Road Initiative. Right. China's efforts here in loaning money to these to developing nations largely, to develop infrastructure throughout, is really all about gaining leverage, because what China wants to do is transition to a blue water navy as opposed to a green water. They want to get away from literal combat operations and move to deep sea operations, global operations. And with this infrastructure that they're setting up in South America, in Africa, throughout Europe, they're making themselves the new center for global commerce. Right now, all roads run to America when it comes to global commerce. People tend to trade in dollars, even though the euro was stronger for some time. People tend to talk in terms of how much money this is worth in the American market. People tend to speak English when it comes to international business dealings. China, which is probably the only economy that can compete with the United States in the world right now, is working through the Belt and Road Initiative and through other efforts like this to redirect that global commerce direction into China. And I know that that doesn't seem like a national security concern. It absolutely is. Our economic leverage is one of our best defensive assets. It's the reason why sanctions work. You know, North Korea really is struggling under the economic sanctions put on it by the international community, championed by the United States. Russia is struggling under the sanctions that were championed by the United States because we have so much economic power, because all roads lead to America. Over the next 50 to 100 years, we might see a shift where all roads lead to China. And what we become then is, instead of the people who get to decide where these sanctions are placed, we'll still have a powerful economy, certainly. But God knows, China, who could have leverage over any number of nations because they owe these huge debts to China, could easily later on establish sanctions on the United States that could really hinder our own economic growth. We could see our roles reversed, you know. Because of that, look at Russia. Russia is having to reorganize their entire military apparatus around funding only certain programs, only their submarine programs, because in part our sanctions are just really stifling to them. They can't afford the full apparatus expenditures that they wanted. We could fall into that same trap if we allow, you know, these diplomatic efforts to move in China's direction. And the South China Sea sees a third of all global commerce per year. You know?
Think about that. The South China Sea sees 89% of the oil that China uses comes through the Malaccan Straits.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
Something like, 100% of the global communications that move in that direction move underneath in cables that go through the Malaccan Straits. And so you're seeing an evolution of the Belt and Road Initiative that China, you know, mass trillion dollars initiative.
I mean, they're taking, you know, their cues from what we did after World War II.
Right.
You know, they're building up these developing nations. After World War II, they were previously developed nations that were in ruin. But China's building up these developed nations because just as today Europe still relies on America economically, militarily, diplomatically, China is trying to establish its own network of nations that will rely on it in the very same ways.
And it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, if you listen to Almond Radio, I think you're pretty familiar. You know, you hear Grant Newsham comes on and you just talk about, you hear him talk about the gangster-like, you know, tactics that China uses with its economy and how we're going to give you this, you know, and whether it,
you know,
we're talking
and
about the,
we don't realize how far reaching it is. It even, it's even in Hollywood, you know, I've written about this a couple of times, but China exerts such an influence over our movies that a lot of big movies are edited specifically or written specifically for Chinese markets. Doctor Strange is a Marvel movie where the Ancient One was a Tibetan character. Tibet obviously is a contested region with China. China wouldn't let them release the film in Chinese markets, which would have cost them hundreds of millions of dollars if they had used a Tibetan character to play the Ancient One. So instead they cast a white lady, you know, and Marvel here in the United States took a lot of flack for whitewashing the character, and they chose to eat that flack rather than acknowledge that the real reason was that Chinese censors mandated the change.
Let me tell you, they eat the flack in order to make the money.
Make hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, Avengers Endgame made $200 million in China opening weekend. You know, it's such a huge market that we can't, that these studios can't afford to risk. Here in America, we have the MPAA, which may be a heavily faulted organization.
What is the what is the MPAA?
The Motion Picture Something Association. Oh, okay. I'm drawing a blank. But they're the people who come up with our film ratings, you know, rated R, PG-13. That's not government mandated. You don't need to have your film rated in order to be released. But most large theater chains won't release an unrated film, right? So you need to get that rating from the MPAA to be commercially viable. But there's no law that requires that you get it. China doesn't work that way. China maintains government censors. The government determines what films can be released and how they need to be edited. And because of that, the Chinese government exerts a great deal of influence over American films that are going to be released in Chinese markets. You know, there's a laundry list of movies that have been changed, some of them a lot, some of them a little. One of the recent Mission Impossible movies had to go back and use CGI to remove the clotheslines that were shown on Chinese skyscrapers, because in China, a lot of people do use clotheslines on the roof of the skyscraper to dry their clothes, but the Chinese censors felt as though it depicted China as an impoverished nation. So they made the studio, I think it was Paramount or Universal, go back and use CGI to remove the clotheslines or they wouldn't release the film in their theaters. You know, other times it's more, ridiculous. Like the Mandarin in Iron Man 2 has been a traditionally Chinese character. He's supposed to be Iron Man's arch villain. You know, he's Batman's Joker. But instead they cast Sir Ben Kingsley to play the Mandarin and had him just kind of be like a shill off to the side, again, because China wouldn't permit the film to be released if they had depicted the Mandarin as a villain and B, Chinese. You know, the new Red Dawn, they filmed that entire movie with China as the antagonist. And then when the Chinese censors came in and lodged a complaint, they went back and used CGI to change all of the flags to North Korean flags, which made no sense in the context of the film. But they did it anyway, just in hopes of making some money. You know, so right now what people don't realize is that we're censoring our movies for China. 30 years from now, what people don't realize is that that means my daughter's generation is going to grow up watching American films that only show China in a positive light, that only depict China as an economic and diplomatic powerhouse, that only show China's military as something that we need to be afraid of in the United States. The United States doesn't mandate these sorts of things on our films. A lot of times Hollywood tends to be fairly critical of the United States military infrastructure. So what we're getting is a cultural shift where we're happy to embrace China militarism and Chinese forced diplomacy because our pop culture tells us it's good. But we're also extremely critical of our own foreign policy, extremely critical of our own military endeavors that are, and more often than not, benign compared to China's. We're going to see an interesting perceptual shift in the coming decades, and I'm worried about it.
Well, let me tell you, I think that's why the confrontation that the Trump administration is currently embroiled in with the Chinese is critically important to the world.
It is.
Not
it really
just,
is.
Not just the United States, because if the world, and that's why, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of the French, but the French last week and in the past few weeks sent French naval vessels
through the Taiwan Strait?
Yeah, through the Taiwan Strait and into the South China Sea, saying that, look, it's all of our responsibility to make sure that these trade lanes stay open. And the Chinese, just because they say it so, doesn't make it right and doesn't make it true and doesn't mean that we all should play by these ridiculous rules that they develop. And again, I've said this before, but if the United States, Japan, Australia, the UK, France and other Korea and other free nations of the world who they trade with to huge numbers look at them and say, we're not having this. Okay, then guess what? It's not going to happen.
Absolutely.
But my opinion is it makes things very difficult for whatever reason when all these other nations don't even show up. And it's the United States out there.
It's a double-edged sword, too, because then it gives North Korea the opportunity – And they did do this to pursue the narrative of being bullied, right? When the United States is the only nation that shows up, to your average layman who's just passing by the headlines, it's easy to misconstrue America sending these freedom of navigation voyages through the South China Sea as American interventionalism in the Pacific. Because if you don't know that the South China Sea extends for more than 1,000 miles away from Chinese shores, and I mean, when you hear South China Sea, you assume that it's a lake in southern China. You don't assume that it's the portion of the Pacific Ocean that reaches Vietnam, you know? So if you just pass by that headline that America is once again pissing off China, and I will say Xi Jinping, China's president, has done an excellent job of not being a Vladimir Putin in the international press. He comes off as reasonable. He comes off as well-intentioned. Because of that, it's easy to convey the idea that America, who doesn't have far-reaching Pacific interests, feasibly speaking, you could say, because our Pacific coast doesn't extend, obviously, very close to China, it's easy to think that we're just over there being the bully until you actually get down into the nitty-gritty of it and you see that China is forcing Vietnamese oil workers off of their own platforms and claiming them as their own. Until you find out that, you know, commercial fishing vessels out of the Philippines are being pushed out of their own territorial waters by the Chinese Coast Guard, 1,000 miles away from Chinese shores. It's really easy to make it seem as though America's the bad guy when we're the only one over there trying to do the right thing. Right. So when nations like England and like France and like Australia, as you're saying, get into the mix of things, it shows that it's not a unilateral decision by the United States to go puff out our chest. It really is in the world's best interest, you know?
And again, we need to do that, right?
It's essential. It's absolutely essential.
Right.
And for anybody out there who might be thinking, you know, so what if, you know, the roads all start leading to China? Maybe it is time for a change. I know a lot of people tend to be critical of the United States government and of our economic policies, in large part because we are absolutely a flawed apparatus. There's a million things that are wrong with the United States that we're always trying to fix. And there are a million things that are always getting worse, just as there are lots of things that are getting better. But to anyone who thinks that it wouldn't be that big a deal globally, maybe it would be tough on America, but globally it would be fine for China to take the lead in this role. It's important that you remember that there's a reason why we tend to think that America is as flawed as it is. And that's because we are allowed to, we are welcomed to, we are encouraged to constantly continue discussing how flawed we are and what those flaws are. We mistake our ongoing conversation about our flaws with being overly flawed. In China, you don't get to talk about what the government's doing wrong. You don't get to be critical of the new policy.
You can.
You can if you'd like to do it in jail.
All right.
You know, so although at first glance, it might seem that China doesn't have all the controversy that we do here in the United States. Maybe you love Donald Trump. Maybe you hate him. Maybe you love Nancy Pelosi. Maybe you hate her. China seems like a more unified front, but it's for a reason. It's because China mandates the unified front.
Yeah, they don't.
There's
they
no
don't
room
allow
for a dissenting voice.
Right. Right.
No, here in America, we're still beholden to the people. As much as we sometimes feel powerless, outrage still really does force change. You can see it in our lawmakers all the time, because as of late, all they're really concerned about is headlines and outrage. You know, in China, the people don't have any power over how decisions are made or why decisions are made. That does not benefit the global population in any way.
That's why, to me, the article about the little green men, the militia running around, you know, ramming fishing vessels, ramming support vessels that are moving to oil platforms. And that is the only thing they're not using is a 5-inch gun. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And as a result of that, we call them a maritime militia.
Right.
Even though chances are good, as you mentioned, that they've received traditional military training. They're probably being paid by the Chinese government, maybe even through their Ministry of Defense arm or the PLA arm. But we refer to them as a maritime militia because of basically the way their ships are designated.
Right. The appearance of the vessel that they do. That's why, to me, what was interesting is there's an article running around. I can't remember who wrote it. I want to say Reuters or somebody wrote a big article about aircraft carriers in the South China Sea. What carries more weight, aircraft carriers in the South China Sea, in the Med as a message to the Russians, or little green men with no insignia on their shoulders, affiliated with no nation? Which carries more weight? Which is to be feared more? To me, the little green men that go in to destabilize a nation, that then are used as the pretense for Russian involvement, that's, you know, I mean, the aircraft carrier is a great tool if you get to that point, but we don't normally get to that point.
I would argue that an aircraft carrier is as much a diplomatic tool as it is a tool of war, right? And the reason why I say that is because
So which is the greater diplomatic tool? Little green men that I can stick on you any day I want, or this giant?
This is where we can get into some really complex strategy discussion, because it really depends on what the outcome is that you're pursuing, right? So if the outcome that you're pursuing is you're trying to either escalate or de-escalate tensions, the carrier is the more powerful tool. And the reason being is because an attack on an aircraft carrier is a declaration of war. You cannot attack the USS Nimitz without incurring the wrath of the entire United States military, right? So when we put a carrier in some place like the Mediterranean to try to posture in front of the Russians, what we're really saying is we brought our big bad fighter, and he's here and he's ready to fight. We know that you don't want to fight. We also don't want to fight. We need you to get back to within coloring within the lines of what we're willing to tolerate of your bad behavior, and we'll go back to coloring within the lines of what you're willing to tolerate with what you perceive to be our bad behavior. That's the real reason. This is something that a lot of people forget about defense technology, is that 90% of why we develop new weapons platforms, new capabilities, is just to be able to threaten that we can use them to try to prevent people from forcing us to use them, right? The little green men, on the other hand, the reason why they're so valuable is because they're deniable, right? That's the same way that Russia uses mercenary forces in places like Syria. Because they're deniable, you can do things with the little green men, with the maritime militia. You could do things with these mercenaries in Syria that conventional or even special operations forces that are operating under a flag just can't do without it being construed as a declaration of war, or at the very least, a huge increase in tensions, right? So these maritime militia boats can go and sink Philippines, you know, fishing vessels. They can go scare Vietnamese oil workers off of their platforms. They can go and surround other nations' vessels to intimidate them out of fishing waters. And because there's no Chinese flag on it, it doesn't really create that much of an international incident. Instead, it's just this really shitty thing that happened to this one fishing company. Here in the United States, if you're a newsreader in London, if you're, you know, a guy who's really worried about the stuff in Moscow, you don't really care about three fishing boats that were bullied off of, you know, their traditional fishing territory out in the South China Sea by a group of hostile fishing vessels that were carrying armed Chinese citizens. However, if it was a formal arm of the Chinese military, that would be news, right? So the value, I guess, is in deniability. Right. And so while an aircraft carrier is a really valuable tool when you want everyone to be looking, these little green men and, like, you know, China's maritime militia, things like that, are a great way to get things done in the real world without anybody looking.
And most, and we're not looking 99% of the time.
Absolutely.
Which is what makes them so valuable. So it's like, yeah, you can pray that, you can have that prayed all you want. It's like, I would tell you, it's like the Russians or the North Koreans holding one of their parades where they drive their big nuclear missiles down the road. Like, okay, we got the memo, but guess what? We ain't going there. So yeah. Congratulations. What is, so to me, when you see the little green men, except they're on boats in the South China Sea, that is a significant escalation. And what was interesting is that the CNO, the Chief of Naval Operations, told the Chinese Navy, we will draw no line between your militia, right, and the rest of your Navy. We consider it all one enchilada, which is a fairly substantive statement.
But the challenge is still proving it, you know, and that's where you're going to run into some complications. We could capture, let's say, one of these maritime militia boats, and other than proving that they're all Chinese citizens on the boat, unless there's something there formally tying them to the Chinese government, we're talking about the difference between you and me hopping on my brother's boat and going and, you know, and challenging other fishing vessels with, you know, our AR-15s that we brought with us. That's a completely different thing than if we've got an American flag on our shoulders and we were sent there on orders, right? And so if we're out there in civilian clothes, there's no documentation on the vessel, there's no formal like pay trail that connects me directly to the Chinese military, it's difficult for you to hold the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army's Navy, accountable for my actions, right? So even though we know, you and I look at each other and we know that this was a Chinese government operation. As far as actually being able to justify taking legal action, our hands will be tied, you know, unless we can get some really good information, some really good intelligence, or we find some evidence.
But the United States Navy is saying we don't care.
Ah, see, the United States Navy is saying we don't care as long as we can prove that you are who you say you are. Otherwise, what they're doing is they're just capturing thieves and pirates, you know?
No, because they'll be flying the Chinese flag.
That's only if they are flying the Chinese flag formally. You got to remember that while the Navy can say that we're going to treat you the same way we would treat anyone else from the Chinese military, the Navy isn't ultimately who makes these decisions. You know, it's America's diplomatic arm that decides how we're going to engage with these guys. And if we were, let's say, to get into an actual conflict, an actual standoff or a shootout with these militia guys, it would be the State Department and the executive branch and Congress, perhaps, that would really make the ultimate determination in whether or not we would attribute that to the behavior of the Chinese government or if we would attribute it to the behavior of whatever organization they claim. That wouldn't be a naval decision.
Hmm. You know? Well, I'm curious to see how it plays out amidst the saber rattling and these lines that are,
you know, and
that are
we
being
call it saber rattling, but it is important. The saber rattling matters, man. You know?
Let me tell you, the little green man is a huge escalation, and people will tell you, look, this has been going on for a long time. It's just going on more and more now. So that which I can't achieve through intimidation and through words, right, now I'm going, you know, because now what's happening really is the Filipinos, the Vietnamese are pushing back and saying, you're encroaching on our ability to fish, right? Which is costing
which
our
is fishermen, hugely important right, to both their economies right, and which, their infrastructure.
So our guys are going to, I mean, we have businesses that have to go to sea to make money. And the Chinese are ramming them and trying to keep them out of certain fishing areas because the Chinese have said those belong to us. Never mind that they're 900 miles from the Chinese mainland, right?
Emphasize enough for someone like – for people like me who have – I forgot what it's actually called, but my brain works in a certain way where I don't picture things in my mind, right? I think in terms of language, so I have trouble seeing pictures, right? So when you think of the South China Sea, it's really easy to think of it as like a local waterway. We're really talking about a huge chunk of the Pacific Ocean. You know, and it's so important for people to understand that China is literally saying you can't fish in this huge expanse of the Pacific Ocean anymore. You know, that abuts these foreign countries like Vietnam, like the Philippines. You know, so traditionally you have an economic exclusion zone off the – so your country's territorial waters extend 12 miles on average from your shoreline. And then your economic exclusion zone extends 250 miles. Everything within that 250 miles is generally considered to be property of your nation, oil reserves, fishing, things like that. You know, things that economies are built on.
And if they overlap with another country, which some do around the world, then there is a negotiated settlement of how you deal with the overlapped area.
The very same way you would see territory exchanges done on land.
Right.
You know, we've negotiated border movements with Canada, you know, for two centuries, right? And you would approach it the exact same way. China, however, has declared a historical right over the entirety of that area of ocean, right? Effectively, it's as simple as they're like, well, my name's on it. It's really, you know, it sounds crazy, but it's not actually that much more legal a claim than just that. Their name is on it.
Right. The nine-dash line because we drew it there.
What? Because we drew it there. You know, they based it off of centuries of historical precedent, they claim. But the truth is, it's just a hugely valuable waterway for commerce in terms of shipping things over the surface. It's a hugely valuable waterway and economically in terms of the resources that are held within it. And it is a hugely strategically valuable waterway in terms of military posturing throughout the entire Pacific. It is a really, really important place for American interests and for allied interests, for global interests. But China literally has just called dibs on it. It's like going to a car dealership, licking the door handle and saying it's mine now. Nobody recognizes that as legitimate, but they're just forcing it down our throats so hard that some people are backing off.
Well, and what they do is they play the game they play, which is the, look, do you want access to our economy? You know how
exactly.
Much you trade with us? And if you say no, guess who's going out of office very shortly? You are.
You know, and we're seeing the exact same thing starting to happen in the Arctic with Russia's expansion up there. As sea ice is receding, new shipping lanes are opening, which is going to become a huge, huge source of commerce, particularly for the Russian government because they have such a long stretch of Arctic shoreline. But because we're not up there in the Arctic, we don't have an icebreaker, and our ships don't tend to perform very well in sub-zero temperatures, as we saw this past year, because we don't have an Arctic presence, Russia is going to dominate the Arctic waterways the same way China is trying to dominate the South China Sea. And what we're going to end up seeing is America will still have a great deal of autonomy in the Atlantic. We'll still be able to trade with Europe pretty easily. In the Pacific, if China is able to accomplish their goals in the Pacific, we're going to be paying for access to markets in Asia because we'll have to go through Chinese waters. If Russia gets what they want, we're going to have to pay for access to head through Arctic waterways because they will dominate the entire region. We're going to start seeing contested waterways that America does not have control over very soon. They're instead going to be controlled by China or by Russia, and it's going to reshape the global economy, not in good ways.
Right. That's why it is significant that the free nations of the world stand up as a group and say, hey, look, right, Dr. Evil, you and your Chinese uncle, you guys need to settle the fuck down, okay? These are international waterways, and you need to come back into the family of civilized nations and act in a civilized manner. Because let me tell you, the world cannot stand the Chinese running the global economy. I don't care.
It won't work.
Right. It's not going to work. So the question is, okay, we all need to stand up, right? And you probably need to devote a little bit more money to your defense in Europe as a group, right? Everybody, and to include freeloading Germany, everybody needs to look at the Russians and say, okay, stop it. As a group, right?
Now, another important thing about that, though, is that while we're encouraging them to do this, we need to, and this is one of the biggest criticisms I have of Donald Trump's administration. I know that in America, we really like to think that we're like the sole survivor badass, that we don't need anybody.
Oh.
Isolationism doesn't work. We really need to strengthen our ties with our allies because we like to think that Europe is just always going to be on the American team. If we spend 50 years alienating Europe and threatening Europe, Europe would be foolish not to. European nations would be foolish not to establish stronger trade ties with China, who, as far as they could tell, would be a more stable economic resource than the United States would be, because we're holding their feet to the fire. We need to make sure that we encourage them to do the things that, that the globe needs them to do without making enemies out of every ally we've got, you know? And it's a delicate balance. It takes tact, which is something this administration lacks in spades. But what we really need to do is we need to find ways to counter Russian and Chinese diplomatic and economic expansion without alienating the allies that we have. We can't go it alone. You know, the worst thing that could happen to us as a nation is for the European Union to decide that it would rather do business with China than the United States. Now, that's not going to happen in 5 years or in 10 years. It's not going to happen in 25, more than likely. But 50 years, 75 years down the road, the norms that we accept at face value as just reality may not be there any longer. You know, we're still living off of the boon of post-World War II reconstruction, you know. But now we're transitioning into an era where nations don't need the United States. There's other places they can shop for support. So we need to be a good deal.
No, you know? And again, the things that will always make us a good deal are intellectual property rights, right? The freedom to choose. And that's
human rights.
Right, and human rights. And that's why the things that make the United States a special nation on the planet. However, as Alex said, right, you know, the president pushed away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, okay? And he said there was a better way. He needs to find that better way, okay? Because we need them as much as they need us. And, right, and I think as most nations are finding out, you know, if you dance with the Chinese devil, there is a price to pay. There's a price 100%. To pay in terms of your sovereignty as a nation. And so we have to offer, as Alex said, a better deal. How are you ever going to exist without this conversation? I mean, this is like the easiest thing in the world to start with you.
I know. You know, it's going to be a real transition for me, because I'll tell you the truth. I probably know more at this point about the Belt and Road Initiative than I do about how to pick good rifle optics, you know.
But that's about to change.
You know, it's about to change. But I'll say this, you know, it was like 3.5 years ago maybe now. When I started this job, the first article I ever wrote for SoftRep was just an experience piece about my time. It was called Burying Heroes, and it was about the time that I spent as the non-commissioned officer in charge of a funeral honors team in Massachusetts. And at the time, I knew what I wanted to do was write, but I didn't know what my voice was. I didn't know what I wanted to talk about. I just knew I wanted to talk, I guess, right? And it was working with guys like Jack Murphy that helped me find my voice and helped me find the audience at SoftRep, so that I could find out that I do have a knack for foreign policy analysis. I do have a passion for really digging into the nuts and bolts of this stuff, and that's not really going to be my focus anymore. But I'll say this. Instead, I'm transitioning over to something that on the personal side of my life I've always cared about. You know, there's going to be a much blurrier line between the stuff that I read about and the stuff that I watch on YouTube for work versus the stuff that I read about and watch on YouTube for me. Now they're kind of all going to be the same thing. If anything, I'm basically just going to be doing what I used to do for fun for a living now. So I'm really excited about it. But, man, as far as yelling and screaming about China, I'm not sure if you'll ever be able to stop me. You know?
honestly, it's compelling, and it's one of the most important issues of our time, so I would not expect you to. So you're always welcome here to come on anytime you want to bloviate about current events, and we always appreciate you coming on. So
I love it here on All Marine Radio. You'll have to get security to see me out to get me to stop coming on. So
we won't do that. All right, tell everybody one more time where they're going to be able to find you and where to look for you.
All right. Well, as of this week, starting on Wednesday, I am the managing editor of loadoutroom.com. I would love for you guys to check it out. Reach out to me on social media and let me know what you think of the site. And, you know, you'll be seeing new content from me going up there really soon. Until then, you can find me on The News Rep, where I do a lot of foreign policy stuff. You can also find me on Popular Mechanics and We Are the Mighty. But if you want to skip going to all those different things, just find me on social media, where I run all my stuff. On Facebook @AlexHollingsWriter, on Twitter @AlexHollings52, or you can just go to alexhollings.com and find it all right there.
There you have it. The one and only Alex Hollings here on a Tuesday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.